Want complete protection? Try PhytoGuard, the ultimate nutraceutical combo, a great blend of all the top phytonutrients. I developed it, and it's exclusively available at drhoffman.com. Check it out. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and we have a very special guest in store for you. He is known to many of you. There are a lot of clinicians who listen in to Intelligent Medicine. There's also a lot of enlightened laypersons who listen to Intelligent Medicine, and he is none other than Dr. Jeffrey Bland. Dr. Bland has written a great new book called The Disease Delusion, and we're going to find out about it in just a moment. Let me give you some background on Dr. Bland. He is an internationally recognized leader in the nutritional field for over 35 years. And he has lectured frequently. He's written books. He's known to many of you as the author and editor of Functional Medicine Update, which I recommend very highly. For more than 30 years, he's distributing information to health practitioners. That was the the predecessor to Intelligent Medicine, but geared more towards clinicians. And it's something that we clinicians who practice in various fields of complementary and alternative medicine have come to rely upon as a standard of excellence in disseminating new information about breakthroughs in this field. And I have to say that on a personal note, that Dr. Bland has been an inspiration to me and a mentor. And if not for his influence and some of the information that he shared with us generously over the many years, there's no way that I could be as effective a practitioner as I currently am, because he really has kicked off the functional medicine movement. He's sort of the godfather of functional medicine, and it's a great privilege to have him on the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. So are you sufficiently blushing at this point? I can't see you on Skype here.
Yes, I certainly am, Ron. And I would say that just to pass it back to you, that the title of your show, Intelligent Medicine, there could be no better conveyor of that information than you. When I use examples of individuals in the medical field who have really applied these concepts that we've been working with for the last 30 plus years in ways that really make differences in patient lives, you're right at the head of my list. So I think we have a mutual admiration society. I really appreciate your comments.
Well, thank you very much. And let's see, we got a little electronic sound here, and let's close that. Okay. Funny sounds sometimes appear on electronic media. The new book, The Disease Delusion, this sounds a little bit reminiscent of something that Deepak Chopra might write. You know, disease is a delusion. It's in the mind of Western man. But I don't think that's what you intended in writing The Disease Delusion.
No, not at all, actually. And the title is, I think, a little bit confusing and almost seems internally contradictory. Certainly we have diseases. There's no question about it. And we all study in our medical training histopathology and cytology, so we can recognize under the microscope tissues and cells and organs that are diseased, and we can differentiate them from healthy, not diseased tissue. So we know that there is certainly disease. The delusion, however, I believe, is the thought as to where they come from. And I think for most individuals, and the way we were even trained in medicine, we were trained to believe that most of these chronic age-related diseases, heart disease, hypertension, stroke, diabetes, dementia, cancer, arthritis, that litany of diseases that progress over time and get worse, are really a legacy of our genes. Came, you know, from our mothers and fathers. There's little we could do about it, so we have our heart disease genes, our diabetes genes, our dementia genes, or whatever. And that's been a prevailing theme. I call it the Mendelian paradox. That, you know, Gregor Mendel came up with this concept of dominant recessives many 150 years ago, and that we've been kind of living with it ever since. And until recently, that was the way we thought most of these chronic diseases really came about, was genetic inheritance. But Now in the 21st century, with the deciphering of the human genome, the game has changed, the biology has changed, the truth has changed, and we recognize that only 25 to 30% at most of these diseases come hardwired to our genes. The other 75 to 80% or thereabouts are related to how we experience the environment, lifestyle, diet, stress, exposures to various chemicals, and how that influences our gene expression. So it's how our genes are expressing their response to our environment. It's not just the hardwired disease within our genes. And of course, the good news to that story is where we can't change our genes, we can change the messages that go to our genes and the environment, diet, and lifestyle that are unique to our response. And this is the age of personalized medicine. Medicine of the average is going away and medicine of the person is emerging. And this is our 21st century opportunity to really beat back this rising tide of chronic disease. It's really bringing the country to its knees with increased incidence of diabetes and obesity-related conditions and arthritis and dementia, which are extraordinary burdens not only on the individual but on the disease care delivery system.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, I think the buzzword here is epigenetics, because a lot of people think that our fate is sealed in our genes, and yet you gave the figure, a rough figure, that 75% of it may be within our own hands to modify our risk factors, and that's a hopeful message indeed.
Yes, it is, and I think that, you know, having this week had the opportunity to be with Randy Jertle, who arguably might be considered the father of environmental epigenetics with his discoveries made with the agouti mouse a number of years ago.
And the agouti mouse, for our listening audience, is like a poor hapless mouse that's used in lab experiments?
Yeah, and it's the one that people have modeled diabetes after and heart disease and cancer, because it generally gets these conditions. It eats itself into obesity. It's like eating at the fast food restaurants three meals a day for your whole life, and the mouse ultimately dies young and dies of these diet-related conditions.
So genetically, it's like about 60% of the American populace. It has the gene which predisposes to gorging oneself into metabolic syndrome, diabetes, and death.
Exactly. And what his major discovery was in 1997 is that he found that, lo and behold, when they supplemented the pregnant mouse, a pregnant agouti mouse, with certain levels of nutrients. In that case, they were methylating nutrients, vitamin B12, choline, and folic acid, that although the genes of the animals didn't change, they didn't get fat, they didn't overeat, they didn't get diabetes, they didn't get heart disease, and they lived about 30 to 40% longer than their parents.
Wow.
So that was like, oh my word. You know what I mean? The genes of these animals that we've thought about all these years causing their death didn't actually, when they changed their nutritional environment, they could live long and healthy, and the answer was yes. So it really has created a whole different view of the powerful role that nutrition, lifestyle, environment plays in modulating how our genes are expressed, and ultimately whether they will, sing out the health messages, the blissful health message, or ring in the Greek tragedy messages of chronic illness.
Well, you have really been in the forefront of looking at linkages between genetics and environmental influences, wholesome things that we can do via diet, exercise, and the signaling that is elicited through supplementation. So how do you respond to some of the critics? You know, we're really at kind of a tipping point in our understanding of this, and yet whenever there's a revolution, there's often a counter-revolution. There's a lot of blowback, isn't there? There are a lot of people who are saying, oh, supplements aren't worthwhile. You've seen the headlines, you know, repeatedly we see headlines, resveratrol is no good, fish oil causes prostate cancer, supplements are of no value. You know, this has been your life's work for 35 years or more. How do you respond to those critics?
Well, I think, first of all, in any debate of this type, no matter what it is, there's always some kernel of truth upon which the critics built their story. The question is, how general applicable is that truth? How pervasive is the truth? And how was the truth, in quote, relative truth, exaggerated to make a political or economic point? And in this particular case, as it relates to the dietary supplement, quote, arguments, I think that the truth, as is perceived by a few critics, is exaggerated, is over-amplified, and is not balanced. The reason I say that is that when you start looking at the role of dietary supplements, or let's call it nutrients, on human health, what we all know is that each individual has a very different response to these nutrients than any other individual. There is no, like, one recipe for perfect nutrition that applies to everyone. And so there is a high degree of variability from person to person. So now, how does that relate to a study? If you do a study on a drug is a very strong reactor. It overcomes any kind of genetic variation. It's kind of agnostic to genes. It will just kind of nail down physiology because of the way that that drug has been designed. It's been designed to be very, very active. It will work at levels of extraordinarily high activity.
So it's very laser-like in its effect. It may very specifically hit one enzyme or one gene and just turn that on or turn it off depending on the action of the drug.
Very well said. That's exactly right. Now, nutrient has a lower level activity, but it's across many different functions. So it's not lasered. I don't even want to call it shotgun because shotgun sounds too militaristic. Mm-hmm. What it is, it's like more a massaging multiple sites of physiology across multiple functions. And those then are much more sensitive to different variable differences among individuals based upon their genes. So now how does that relate to a double-blind placebo-randomized controlled study, the so-called gold standard for proving that a drug works? Well, because a nutrient is not a drug and it works differently in different individuals, what you do is you kind of, if you do a group study, you might lose the individual effect on a person within the study or a group of people because it's washed out among those individuals who didn't have the response because of their unique response wasn't tied to that specific nutrient. So what you ultimately get is the assumption in the mass, in the averaging, oh, it didn't work. But if you look at individuals within the mass, in other words, what we call cohort analysis or individual analysis of each person, using them as a control against themselves, you'll find people who had fantastic response, positive response. So this whole way that we study the effects of a drug should not be applied to the way we study the effects of a nutrient. There are new ways of examining nutritional effects individual by individual. We call that cohort analysis or pattern recognition. That when you do that kind of study, you find remarkable effects in the individual of improving health, reducing risk to disease. And so now that begs the question, well, how do we individualize our need? And that's, of course, what I've tried to do in The Disease Delusion, is to talk about how the reader can start to walk down their own discovery of their individual needs based upon the questionnaires that we've been using in our clinical studies over the last 30 years. So this is a new age. This is the age of the individual. You know, as was once said, medicine or nutrition is for the real person. Statistical humans are of little interest.
Well, the buzzword these days, even in conventional medicine, is personalized medicine. And do you think that when it comes to research on vitamins and supplements, you know, I'm in the trenches. I'm implementing the research findings of folks like you who are out there trying to demonstrate that this or that or another nutrient has some efficacy in discovering new planets in the solar system, some things that, you know, we haven't recognized in the past and coming up with new innovations. When we look at, when you do research, do you think that we need a paradigm shift in the way that we do the research on nutrients and supplements? Because it's not working out well.
No, I think that's exactly right, and that is what is happening. And by the way, interestingly enough, this same paradigm shift is happening in the pharmaceutical world. As you know very, very well, most of the low-hanging fruit of drugs for specific kinds of targets have already been developed and already been exploited. Many of those drugs are now becoming generic, which makes the pharmaceutical cupboard very bare, and they're very concerned, the pharmaceutical world, about how to develop new products, because they recognize that the drugs that affect the mass human beings, the average individual, have pretty much been developed. Now we're into the development of new types of drugs that are unique to individuals with specific types of genes, specific personalization. And that requires a different type of study protocol than they've used in the past. And it's the same type of study that I'm talking about that needs to be used for for nutrients. It's a study that individualizes to the need of the person. So you say, does this particular individual have a specific set of characteristics that would suggest they have a need for folic acid or vitamin C or zinc or whatever the nutrient is, and then put those types of subjects in your study so that you have an opportunity to actually look against the placebo at the influence that that nutrient has in a sensitive and personalized form. And that is exactly, by the way, what the drug companies are starting to do. You probably saw that just yesterday the FDA, in fact it's a New York Times editorial column today, I think, in which they discussed this new cancer drug that's been approved by the FDA for a form of small cell cancer, lung cancer, which only about 10% of people have that specific type of tumor. But for those individuals, this specific drug is very effective. But if you just gave it to every patient that had lung cancer, the drug would be shown ineffective because it doesn't work for most types of lung cancer. So here's a specific example of this model I've just described that it should be used for nutritional research that's actually now being used also in pharmaceutical research to personalize.
Well, that's a clear example of the disease delusion, because we tend to lump lung cancers all together. But one person's lung cancer may respond to one or another chemotherapy regimen and or an immunological stimulus, some type of immunotherapy, and or utilizing supplement support. And I think that emerging science is beginning to tell us that we need to differentiate, that we need to break down those old boxes, those categories that were kind of reductive, that lead us to treat everybody one size all, fits all, and leaving a large number of people high and dry with ineffective therapies.
Well, I think, Ron, you just beautifully and very succinctly summarized the reason that I wrote Disease Delusion. That is specifically the focus of the book, is not only to help people to understand exactly what you've said, but also to ask the question, how can that be applied in their lives? How can they start to understand their own individual needs? And then how can they work with their healthcare provider to be a part of the team that's going to find not only solutions for their illness, but to keep them healthy to the limits of their biological potential? And I think these are the things that we have today available to us that we didn't 20 years ago, that we really have the tools to start doing this, to compress illness, to get rid of these things that shouldn't be nagging with us and reducing our function as we get older, and to fight back against things like autism in children and allergies and immune dysfunctions and gastrointestinal problems that cause the need for all sorts of drugs to treat esophageal reflux and the like. All of these are asking the right questions, are able to be managed and prevented and personalized to the individual need of the person.
Well, in the book, you break it down into some baseline assumptions that you want a non-toxic environment, you want some exercise, you want a modicum of a healthy diet, and some baseline of supplementation. Without getting too individualized or personalized, there are a few basic assumptions. So what are some of those assumptions that people can use as a take-home?
Yes, I think after, both of us being down this road for a number of decades now, you start sieving, in my case, probably tens of thousands of different scientific and medical studies, and you start seeing that they fall out into what I call seven piles of key physiological processes that give rise to, when they're disturbed, to the myriad of chronic diseases that steal from us our health. And those seven key or core physiological processes, and that's things like gastrointestinal function, immune function, detoxification function, seven different areas, each can be analyzed and evaluated individually. And I try to do that through each being in a chapter in the book. So what are the questions a person would ask that might help them understand their detoxification processes, and what can they do to improve that? What are the questions a person might ask as it relates to how they would evaluate their gastrointestinal function and those processes? And so by layering on these seven key physiological processes, a person is introduced to an understanding of their own unique strengths and weaknesses, and hopefully a way that they didn't know before they read the book. That allows them then to start designing unique applications of diet, lifestyle, exercise, and stress management programs that are more tailored to their needs, as we describe in chapters 10 and 13 in the book. one size fits all is gone, as you previously stated. It's all about the power of the individual and making sure that there is no one diet that fits all, there's no one supplement program that fits all, there's no one exercise program. How do we make the appropriate adjustments to individualize to our needs? That's the opportunity of the 21st century, which I believe in the book we've tried the reader to help the reader to start to understand.
This is a good inflection point, Jeff, because generally we split these podcasts into two parts. So what we're going to do now is take a pause. Those of you who want to continue, go to part two of today's podcast with Dr. Jeffrey Bland. The book is The Disease Delusion. And coming up, we're going to ask a little bit more about what lies in store for the field of functional medicine. Where can we look for new innovations? Dr. Jeffrey Bland, our guest, is right on the cusp of some of the most exciting new developments in the field of complementary and alternative medicine. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is Intelligent Medicine.